This week's Ramsor Records album of the week is Sammy Walker's Blue Eyed Georgia Darlin'. Born and raised in Norcross, Georgia, Sammy was discovered by famed protest singer Phil Oakes, who landed him a two-record deal with Warner Brothers. The tapes that comprised the album were from the 1975 demo sessions that helped Walker land the deal. Sammy was managed by Howard Leventhal, who managed Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and the Weavers. For more information about Sammy Walker, and to pick up your very own copy of Blue Eyed Georgia Darlin', please visit ramsorrecords.com today. Throughout the latter part of the 20th century, the perception of golf in popular culture was that of a sport of wealthy white men who gathered at their exclusive country clubs, making business deals over 18 holes of golf, all the while smoking expensive cigars and drinking martinis. You know, like in Caddyshack. But then, from out of nowhere, Tiger Woods burst onto the scene, changing the look and style of the sport forever. Well, the truth behind the sport's history is much more complicated and a bit more noble. For example, since 1970, the FedEx St. Jude Classic Golf Tournament has raised over $33 million for the hospital. This week on The Road to Now, we speak with Dr. Tony Parker, historian at the World Golf Hall of Fame and Museum in St. Augustine, Florida, and we discuss the history of golf. I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Why is Ian on this episode?
Ian is this episode. Ian, our producer, came to us a few months ago and said, would you like to do an episode about the history of golf? And I was like, yes, please, please, can we do this episode? Golf was such a big part of my my childhood, not because I was a great golfer, but my grandfather was a club pro in Atlantic City, New Jersey. I have so many memories of watching golf at my grandparents' house growing up or going to the golf course. My very first job, he taught golf lessons, and I went and would retrieve the balls after the lessons, and I would have a hot dog and a Coca-Cola in the clubhouse after work. And then he and I would drive to the racetrack, Atlantic City Racetrack, and he would place his bets for the day, and I would sit there with him. And another great memory I have of him is, and these are just, he passed away, I guess, in 1991. So these are just really valuable, precious memories to me. And I would get in his car, he'd pick me up in the morning, and he would have the big band station on. And this is, you know, I guess the late 70s. So if you think about commercial radio, what we would now call terrestrial radio, like I guess nowadays you have the 90s station, right?
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, you had the 50s station and you had the big band station because a lot of those people were still alive and the music of your youth is very nostalgic to you. And I remember riding in the car with him and him saying, isn't this boring? Don't you hate this music or isn't it boring to you? And I would just say, no, I loved it. I just really loved it. And I feel like that is a great musical foundation for me. Loving the big band music of my grandfather's era and then the 50s music of my parents' era were just very formational to me. So this golf episode set off in me a great nostalgic journey that I'm so glad we got to do it. Ian, thank you so much for bringing this to the table.
Oh man, I was more than happy to. I got to meet today's guest, Tony Parker, at a golf show here in Nashville, and he was giving a talk. He is featured on the Golf Channel, and he is the World Golf Hall of Fame official historian. And I was recently talking to him the other day, and he just got back from St. Andrews, where he played like 4 rounds of golf at the old course and at Carnoustie. Man, I was so jealous to hear about that. I would give anything to... I've been over there once before to play, and it's amazing. It's a different form of golf there than it is here. But yeah, what a wealth of knowledge this guy has.
I think we often get caught up in the image of the American as the rugged individual. And golf is a sport where it's you against yourself. You know, I mean, we have tournaments where you are competing against others, but at the end of the day, it's you against you're playing yourself. You're playing the course, really. I think that really captures a bit of the American spirit, or what we perceive to be the American spirit. So I hope everyone enjoys this episode, and thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of The Road to Now. Dr. Parker, welcome to The Road to Now. Could you talk a little bit about the history of the sport? Where and when did it originate?
Okay, well, that's almost indeterminate, but there are a lot of controversy about that. The Dutch believe that it started in the Netherlands. Of course, the French believe it started in France. Italy even claims it. Chinese claim it. But the game as we know it started in Scotland and principally in St. Andrews, Scotland. Now, we know initially the first time golf is really mentioned is in 1457. And we know by 1457, it was a well-established game. Everybody was playing it. And the reason in 1457 we know is because at that time, James II, the King of Scotland, banned the playing of golf because he found out his soldiers were spending more time on the golf course than they were practicing their arms and archery, which at the time they were at war in England. It didn't really work. They tried banning it again in 1471. That didn't work. Again in 1491. Again, it didn't work. And so finally in 1502, when James IV, the King of Scotland, married King Henry of England's daughter, peace broke out. And the first thing James IV did was order a set of golf clubs from Perth in Scotland and lifted the ban. So like I say, the earliest we know that it's well established by 1457.
So why did he order golf clubs from Perth?
Well, at that time, there were two groups of folks who were making golf clubs, and primarily those the same guys who made archery, bows, arrows, and that kind of thing, woodworkers. You had St. Andrews, you had Perth, you had Edinburgh, and you had Aberdeen. Those four places in particular where golf was really getting a foothold. He did also order golf clubs from St. Andrews, and there are records in the National Archives in Scotland, a receipt for where he ordered golf clubs and golf balls from a club maker both in Perth and in St. Andrews.
So I guess we have the old saying, turning swords into plows, can also apply to, say, turning arrows into golf clubs?
I think that'd probably be a good analogy, exactly right. Yeah, I've not heard that, but that's quite good, actually, yes.
So Mary Queen of Scots was a golfer.
She was indeed. As a matter of fact, she was criticized for playing golf in 1567 because just a week prior, her husband, Lord Darnley, had met an untimely demise. And the following week, she was out on the golf course playing golf and a game called Pall Mall. Now, again, part of the criticism was not that she was playing golf, but the fact that she was doing it the week after her husband had died. Now, of course, my take on that is quite simple. Where else can you find quiet and solitude away from the maddening crowds than on the serenity of the golf course and the fairways and the greens? Great place of solitude.
Where we get the term 18 holes from, but also if you could talk a little bit about old Tom Morris and young Tom Morris.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of my favorite subjects. 18 holes was established in 1764 in St. Andrews. And like I say, the game as we know it, the rules of the game, development of the game, St. Andrews is the place. And in 1764, at that time, they had 22 holes, which really was just 11 holes out, turn around, play the same 11 holes back. But the RNA, which was established in 1754, determined that four of the holes were just too short. So they eliminated those and came down to 18 holes. And that became 18 holes became the standard for a complete competition, whether it be played on a six-hole course or a nine-hole course. 18 holes seemed to be the terminal number for a competition. So 18 holes seemed to be just right. That seemed to work pretty well in St. Andrews. It's kind of interesting because as the game progressed, the game itself took off. I mean, it really exploded. Everybody began playing. And they found out that the 18 holes playing nine out, turn around playing the same nine back, caused quite a bit of confusion because people ran into each other playing the same hole.
Right.
So that's when St. Andrews developed their double greens. For example, the fifth hole and the 13th hole share one green, and that green is 100 yards deep and 100 yards wide. So that seems to work out pretty well in St. Andrews, for sure.
And young and old Tom Morris, like, how influential were they for the game?
Well, you know, old Tom is considered the pretty much the father of the game. He did a lot of work at St. Andrews. He designed the Prestwick Golf Club. Actually, he designed over 70 golf courses around the UK and Ireland. But he he's the old man of golf. He lived until 1908. But he played in the very first Open Championship in 1860. He was the one that struck the first ball in the first Open. He didn't win that year. A fellow by the name of Woody Park Sr. did. But he did win four Open Championships in the 1860s. So he established himself pretty much as the premier golfer until his son, young Tom Marr, superseded him by winning the Open in 1868. And, of course, the runner-up at that time was funny, was his dad, old Tom Morris. Wow. Young Tommy, I considered young Tom Morris to be the first professional golfer. And what I mean by that is you have golf professionals whose livelihood is, certainly at that time, was making golf clubs, making golf balls, keepers of the green, you know, golf course superintendents, designers of golf courses, and would play money matches and that kind of thing. They did not make their living from playing golf. Young Tom Morris made his living one way. He played golf for money. So I consider young Tom Morris to be the first professional golfer. And, of course, sadly, he died at age 24 after he had won four Open Championships consecutively. So he has certainly made a mark, and we can only guess how great his reputation could have been had he lived past the age of 24.
So you say that he was the first professional golfer. Where did the money come from early on?
Well, okay, initially it came from betting. You know, you'd have wealthy patrons who would sponsor their man to play, and they'd put so much money in the pot, and whoever won the matches would take the money. And matter of fact, the first three Open Championships, there was no prize money. The winner just got to wear the champion's belt, which is made out of solid silver.
Wow.
Much like today's trophies, he got to keep it for a year, but then, of course, had to give it back. And it wasn't until 1863 that prize money was given to the second, third place. And finally, 1864, the winner got a total of £6, which was about $500. But from there, of course, you would have club sponsors. You would have others kind of put money into it, those who were sponsoring things like the Open Championship. So sponsorship did kind of come in. But initially, it was by wealthy patrons betting on the matches, and the winners would get a portion of the winnings.
So how did the sport catch hold in the States?
When it really took off, wasn't until the 1880s. Although we have records of golf being played in America as early as 1739, which is actually, you know, before the RNA was even established, in Charleston, South Carolina. Hmm. And we have records of golf balls, 96 golf clubs, 432 golf balls being sent from Edinburgh at Leith to Charleston, South Carolina in 1743. And the first golf club organization in the United States, Charleston, South Carolina, 1786. But that was gone by the War of 1812. So the next time we see golf really making its appearance in America is in the 1880s, right at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And what's happening here is, of course, there is a real rise of immigrants coming in, and a lot of Scots, I have to say, were ones who came over to take advantage of this. But you also had wealth being generated, and now you've got a lot more leisure time. And you had the Scots, a lot of professional golfers from St. Andrews, from Carnoustie, from Perth, and from Edinburgh, came over to design golf courses, to make golf clubs, and to teach now we have to say the more affluent individuals, teach them the game of golf. And it really exploded right after the turn of the century, 1900s or so. But what really grew the game in the United States, I mean, you had the leisure classes playing, was 1913 when Francis Ouimet played the greatest game ever played, when a young immigrant, son of immigrant parents, a working class individual who had a caddy, wins the U.S. Open Championship in 1913, and he beat Harry Vardon and Ted Ray, the two at the time, the two greatest golfers in the world. And here made front page news throughout the United States, and people saying, hey, maybe that's something I can do too. And so the game really explodes, thanks primarily to Francis Ouimet.
I would imagine that American presidents kind of have gotten the reputation over the past 30 years of playing golf, and it makes sense to me.
Absolutely. Well, not just the past 30 years. I mean, we had, starting with Howard Taft, he was the first president we know of that played golf. But then you had Woodrow Wilson, who followed him, who has recorded playing a little bit around 1,200 rounds of golf in his 8 years in office. Of course, he says it was under doctor's orders. But, I'm sure he felt pressure to the time. Matter of fact, every president in the 20th century and now into the 21st century have been golfers, with the exception Herbert Hoover, Harry Truman, and Jimmy Carter. Those are the only three presidents that we know of that didn't play golf while they were in office. And we know Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, played 800 rounds of golf during his 8 years in the White House. And as a matter of fact, the Democrats kind of criticized him for saying, he worked a 36 hole work week. And the best president we have so far as handicaps go is our current president. He's a 2.8 handicapper. But then JFK was a single digit handicapper as well. People didn't know that he played much golf, mainly because the criticism for Eisenhower and then Kennedy following him, he didn't advertise it, but he certainly played a lot of golf as well.
And George W. Bush stopped playing golf after the Iraq War?
That's right. Yeah, he felt that he only played 24 rounds of golf during his presidency because he felt it wouldn't be right for him to be on the golf course while there were young men and women fighting a war overseas.
But it sounds like this, the whole criticism of presidents spending time on the golf course, it sounds like this is in no way a new thing.
It's definitely not a new thing. Matter of fact, when Eisenhower was elected, one of the first things he did was install a putting green in a bunker on the South Lawn of the White House. Nixon did away with that, but then when Clinton came into office, he turned right around and put them back out there. You got to give them credit. They've got to get away from the pressures of government on occasion. Maybe not 800 rounds or 1,200 rounds. I know Clinton played around 400 rounds while he was in office. And Obama, if we took statistics, I think he played 306 rounds of golf while he was president.
So you say that the game began to die off around the War of 1812. Did that have to do with it being associated with Great Britain? Was it the idea that was somehow, because I know there was a lot of anti-British sentiment after the Revolution and especially during the War of 1812. Did that affect the game?
I think it's a little bit simpler than that, actually. It wasn't anti-British because, again, at the end of the War of 1812, the United States' biggest trading partners was Great Britain. So that really didn't make a whole lot of change there. But what did happen after the American Revolution, and certainly after the War of 1812, is a lot of the Scottish immigrants who had come over at that time went back to the U.K. And, of course, they were the ones who brought the game to the United States to begin with.
Yeah, and one of those Americans who, there's a great story, a famous American golfer who kind of went back to St. Andrews in Scotland. Can you kind of tell us the story of Bobby Jones and his first British Open?
Yeah, Bobby went over in 1921, a 19-year-old kid, and on the 11th hole, which is a treacherous par three, I can tell you, he went into the hillside bunker. There's two bunkers in front of the 11th hole. There's the Strath bunker, which is right in front of the green, and then to the left there's the hillside bunker, which if you're standing on the green, it's about a 10, 12-foot drop straight down. Well, Bobby got into the bunker, and he was already complaining. He wasn't playing so very well. So I think he shot 46, actually, on the front nine. Got into the bunker and couldn't get out. Finally, when he did get out, he was so frustrated, he picked up his golf ball, tore up his card, and walked off the golf course. Made a complaint about this being a cow pasture and the worst golf course he had ever seen. But then he thought about it. He came back in 1927, of course. Well, 1926, he played the Walker Cup in St. Andrews and won handily. 1927, he comes back and he wins the Open Championship at St. Andrews. But by that time, he had already learned to appreciate the subtleties of the old course in St. Andrews. And for Bobby Jones, he said it's the greatest course in the world, and by far his favorite. And he said, if I could take out of my life everything except St. Andrews and my time on the old course, I would have lived a rich, full life. So he was a huge admirer of St. Andrews, especially the old course. And when he built Augusta with Alistair McKenzie, who was also another big fan of the Old Course at St. Andrews. He modeled it on the Old Course at St. Andrews.
The idea of developing and built designing a golf course, how much has it changed? Is it still kind of the essential original principles still at play, or has there been a great deal of innovation?
It depends on who you talk to. A great deal of innovation, I would say, on one hand. On the other hand, you've got people where there's the golden age of golf course architecture, which is back in the 1920s, 1930s, and maybe a little earlier, when you've got people like Donald Ross and Seth Rainer, and you've got Alistair McKenzie, and you've got these guys, A.W. Tillinghast. Their principle was to make a golf course primarily look as natural as possible, but at the same time, every hole be unique and spectacular. There was certainly differences between McKenzie and Ross and others. But the way the original courses were designed, especially people like O. Tom Morris or J.H. Taylor, these kind of guys back in the 19th century, they believed in looking at a piece of land and seeing the natural lie and use as much of nature without man-made intrusions as much as possible. And this was the same way that McKenzie certainly came along. He looked at it and said, you know, it should be as natural looking as possible. I mean, if you've got to put in bunkers, make it look like they've always been there. But now you've got the modern architects of golf, you know, Pete Dye and Tom Doak and these guys who come in. They add water. You know, they put in blind shots. They put in a lot of bunkering. And so that's a change really from the earlier times, from the 1920s and 30s or so.
Even the most passive observer of sports knows about the Masters. Where does the history of Augusta and Augusta National, how does that fit in with the history of the sport?
Well, that again, is to me, it's a seamless transition from St. Andrews to the United States, because that was the whole driving force between Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie, was to create, again, this basic idea of a golf course that's playable by the scratch golfer, the professionals, as well as the high handicapper. Make it a golf course that is tough and a challenge for professionals, but at the same time, make it in such a way that the average golfer, can look at a hole and play a different angle. I don't have to go for it all the time. There's a safety there, net over here. There's a bailout area. I can play it this way. So this was in homage to the Old Course at St. Andrews. And it was a driving force, the greatest fun for the greatest number. Make it playable by everyone. And I think that's what they've done. And, of course, every hole is absolutely spectacular individually. Every hole is beautiful with the natural scenery around it. Although, you know, you bring it in hundreds and hundreds of plants and flowering plants and things. But again, it's getting into nature. And if you've been to Augusta, certainly during the Masters, it is a magical place, absolutely magical.
It's one of the rare tournaments where it's played there every year. Can you kind of explain why the Masters is only played at Augusta National every year, whereas things like the British Open are, you know, they move to different locations every year?
Yeah, well, again, you have to go back to the very foundation of the Masters. It was initially called the Augusta Invitational. And it was set up primarily by Bobby Jones and Cliff Roberts to invite their professionals and their friends to play a tournament and on what they considered soon to be the greatest course in the United States. And then it developed from there, and it was only in the professional parlance when the pros said, this is where, you know, you strive to play, this is where you want to go. And of course, Augusta is the place. That's where it started, that's where it's always going to be. Now, it's the same with the Players Championship. You know, in 1974, when Dean Beaman said that they wanted to establish a tournament for the players, for the professional players, touring players, that they can call their own. And so it's always played, we're from 1982, it's always been played at TPC Sawgrass. That's the home of the players, much as Augusta is the home of the Masters, and that'll never change.
I wanted to ask a question about that follows up on something earlier. You mentioned that Mary Queen of Scots was a golfer, and that the interesting thing is that in the 20th century, golf was very much a male associated sport. And I know Augusta did not even allow women to become members of the club until recently. What was it that made the sport become such a male sport? And what do you think then led it to recently be more accepting of women?
Well, I think that's a little misunderstanding in that, because women have been involved with the game pretty much from the very beginning. The first women's competition I know of was actually held by some Scottish fisherwomen, which from the socioeconomic standpoint are very low down the ladder. And they played, and the winner got a scarf. And this was in the 17th century. And again, you mentioned Mary Queen of Scots played. So women have been involved. In the United States, let's go back. In St. Andrews, there are six golf clubs. There's the Royal and Ancient, which up until last year did not allow women. There's the St. Andrews Golf Club, which was pretty much the same. The new golf club, which is male-dominated. But by the same token, you get St. Rules and St. Regulus golf clubs, which are women-only. Now, the first women's golf club was established in St. Andrews in 1867 and is still in operation today. So women have been there. And like I say, in St. Andrews, they have the exact same rights, privileges, and everything as every other club in town. That's a little bit of a misnomer. In the United States, because of the way golf grew in the 1880s and onwards, like I say, it was leisure time afforded by the Industrial Revolution. And you did have men and women's golf clubs, and women were part of it. Matter of fact, if you look at the establishment of the USGA, United States Golf Association, they had in 1895 the U.S. Amateur and the U.S. Women's Amateur Championship. Like I say, women have been there. They've just been overshadowed by a lot of the more private or exclusive clubs that would be for men only, like Augusta. And because that's more in the news than a lot of other clubs, then apparently it's an issue. But by and large, you'll find women have always been around. I mean, if you go back to the 1930s, so women have been playing. I mean, you've got Babe Zaharias, you got Patty Berg, you got Louise Suggs, all the way up, especially from the 1930s. Even before then, you've got Alexa Sterling, who played with Bobby Jones quite a lot. Women did not get really into professional golf, and that might be where the difference is. Men's professional golf has certainly been at the fore for quite a while. But women's professional golf really didn't take off until the mid-1930s. They've kind of been overshadowed by men, but they've been there. They've always been there.
What about some of the stars? Like, my grandfather was a club pro at Atlantic City Country Club in the 70s, in the early 80s, and I have golf was just always on in my home and in my grandparents' house. And I grew up with Calvin Peet, Lee Trevino, yeah. Some of these great golfers. For me, in my life, that period of the 70s was kind of a golden age in itself for golf. Can you talk about when did golf in the 20th century really become a spectator sport?
Oh, well, no, you got to go back earlier. I mean, Bobby Jones really raised it. And like I say, when Francis Ouimet won in 1913, people started coming to the tournaments more and more because now he's one of us. We can play this. Bobby Jones comes on the scene. Then you got Walter Hagen, Gene Saracen. And then from them, you come into Ben Hogan, Byron Nelson, Sam Snead. I mean, these guys are household names. But it really wasn't until Arnold Palmer, really starting about 1958 when he won the Masters, but 1960 when he won the Masters and the U.S. Open, here, and television comes in with the second Masters in 1958, 59, I think. So now it's televised. People are starting to see this, and now they're starting to come out to the tournaments. So you really kind of give credit to two things. Well, three things, really. Dwight D. Eisenhower, because he played so much golf and quite open about it, the rise of television and televised golf, and then Arnold Palmer. And Palmer made such an impact that people really started flocking to it. Arnie's Army. I mean, let's talk about Arnie's Army. And then, of course, you've got the firebrand. Jack Nicklaus comes on the scene.
Golden Bear.
Kind of takes off from the Golden Bear. And so it takes off from there. But these two guys, along with Gary Player, the first international guy to win the Masters in 1961, so now it's a global thing. And then you get into the rise of people like Seve Ballesteros, who is I loved watching him as much as anybody I've ever seen. With his fiery personality, I mean, he was very, I want to say, Palmer-esque in the sense of being a crowd pleaser and really stirring up emotions.
I remember being a big fan of Chichi Rodriguez and Payne Stewart.
Chichi was here. He visited with us about 3 months ago on his birthday. And we had a packed house when we did a little Q&A with him. But yeah, Chichi, again, his personality when he'd do his little Toreador sword swing.
Oh, yeah.
When he stuck a putt and stuck it in there. And Payne Stewart, I mean, Payne, you know, with his plus fours, colorful individual, and just an all-around good guy. But he brought crowds as well. I mean, one of my favorite pictures, which I actually just posted on home, my Facebook, I think 3 or 4 days ago, and on Twitter. One of my favorite pictures is of him playing at Augusta at the Masters, wearing, in essence, a tuxedo, you know, the white shirt with a bow tie with the cufflinks and black silk trousers and the white socks and black and white shoes. I mean, he looked like he was wearing a tuxedo on the golf course. Very, very stylish and very visible. So yeah, these guys command attention, not just with their golf, but with their personalities. And I think that separates golf from other sports, where you've got personalities in baseball and you get personalities in basketball and you get personalities in football. But all these are team events. Whereas in golf, you get the personality. It's you against the course. It's you against the field.
Well, so you mentioned Tiger Woods. What impact did he make when he entered the game?
Well, let me preface Tiger with somebody like Charlie Sifford, or you mentioned Calvin Peet. Charlie Sifford, of course, until 1961, the PGA of America had a Caucasian-only rule. So if you were any other ethnicity other than Caucasian, you could not be a member of the PGA of America. Well, Charlie Sifford qualified, and in 1960, they gave him an approved player's card. He couldn't be a member, but he could play on the tour. 1961, they did away with that clause because of Charlie Sifford. And so, therefore, he opened the door for all ethnicities, not just African Americans, but all ethnicities to play. Because of that, you've got somebody like Calvin Peet come along. Now, Calvin, in the 1980s, was the third winningest player on the tour. Only Tom Kite and Tom Watson won more tournaments than Calvin did in that decade. And between 1982 and 1986, Calvin won more than any other player on the tour. He was on the 1983 and 1985 Ryder Cup teams. And he's the first African-American to win the Players' Championship. He also led the tour 10 consecutive years in driving accuracy. So, you know, here's a guy who really made an impact. And as one fellow said not long ago in another little public panel that we did, he said he walked with Calvin in that final round of the 1985 Players. And he said, Calvin not only won the tournament, he won the crowd. And I think because of people like Calvin, when Tiger came along, and let's face it, you know, Tiger intimidated and dominated the tour in the late 1990s and early 2000s with his sheer power. And, of course, when he won the Masters in 97 and then in 2000, winning about 15 strokes at the U.S. Open at Pebble, he intimidated the other players quite significantly. But on the other hand, he also showed a lot of young people of color that, hey, if he can do it, I can do it too. So he made a real strong impact. And the beauty of Tiger is that he did not identify himself as an African American, but rather as a Caublin Asian, Caucasian, Black, Indian, Asian. And so everybody in the world could claim Tiger Woods, and that's pretty significant.
Where do you see the sport today, and where do you see it headed?
Well, that's a fantastic question. I think because you're seeing things like the Drive, Chip, and Putt program, the First Tee, the LPGA Girls, the PGA of America team for young people, you're seeing a lot of proactivity going into getting young people on the golf course. Now, one of the big problems we're facing now is, and I hate using this term, but the millennials, because we're at a place now where it's perceived as being an expensive game to play and quite time consuming. But what may surprise you is that actually the average round of golf only costs $37 in the United States, which by the time you were to take a date to a movie and popcorn and drinks for, you know, 3 hours in the movie, you spent more than $37. So that's kind of a misconception. So what we've got to do is A, change the perception of the game itself, B, make it more accessible, which I think we're really moving in that direction. C, really show the benefits, the health benefits, the charitable benefits. I mean, it may surprise you to know that golf raises more money in charity than all other professional sports combined.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Matter of fact, last year, $3.9 billion was raised from golf for charity. And most of that's unrelated to the golf industry at all. The health benefits, I mean, folks talk about calories and stuff like that. Well, if you play 18 holes of golf, it burns roughly 2,000 calories if you're walking.
Wow.
And 1,300 calories if you're riding. So there are health benefits as well. Where we need to go with this, or where do we see it going? People are talking about it declining. It's not declining. What's happening is that 9 out of 10 golfers actually play on public access golf courses. 76% of golf is played on public golf courses. So what you're seeing is actually a decline in private club memberships, not the number of golfers actually playing golf. Golfers are now playing other courses, public accessible courses, and to be honest with you, less expensive courses. So golf is alive and it's doing very well. It's just the media kind of presents it in an unfavorable light, but that's just not the case.
Dr. Tony Parker, thank you so much for doing this with us. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Glad to help.
We'll see you out there on the links.
All right.
Take care. Thank you for joining us today on The Road to Now. Our program is produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Edited by Bob Crawford and Ian Scotta. Paul DeFiglia provides our music. Please be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. For more information about this or any other episode, please visit theroadtonow.com. For Dr. Ben Sawyer, this is Bob Crawford. Take care.